Welcome to the Issue Is Podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, a look at where the Democratic Party goes from here, why Donald Trump wins, and sort of how all of this impacts California. Two really interesting conversations. One with Mayor Matt Mahan of San Jose, sort of charting a different path than where a lot of the state Democrats are right now, offering more of a centrist, moderate vision. We'll see if that takes hold in the coming years. And then a conversation with Michael Knowles of The Daily Wire, who is a straight-up conservative, talking about Trump and also some of his why he thinks Newsom could actually be the answer for the Democrats, which was interesting. But let's start with Mayor Matt Mahan. If you remember, he was the first Democratic mayor to come out in favor of Prop 36, which, of course, added some penalties for certain thefts and drug crimes. He said things aren't working. And in this conversation, he goes even further about his frustrations with some of where the Democrat leadership is right now compared to where Democratic voters are. When it came to 36, by the way, some 70% of Californians supported his vision of 36 and not the vision put forward from the Democratic governor and much of the state leadership in Sacramento. Here's Matt Mahan talking about that, about homelessness, artificial intelligence, and his potential future in the state. Take a listen.
Mayor Mahan, welcome back to The Issue Is. Good to see
Alex,
you.
Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
What is going on right now, and what is the lesson from Prop 36?
Well, there's a big gap between where ordinary Californians are and the political establishment in Sacramento. You saw that with 36. Make no mistake, that was a voter revolt. Voters kept telling us they were worried about crime. Sacramento kept saying there's no problem here. They were not serious about it, and voters have voted for change. I'm worried they haven't gotten the message yet. I haven't heard a word about implementation. We need to expand treatment beds and get people the care that they need and have consequences for repeat crime. Similarly, on energy costs, we've got the governor in the Central Valley saying, I hear you, and yet we're passing policies that are going to raise gas prices 65 cents next year. We want EV adoption, but we're talking about excluding the leading EV maker, which actually makes its cars here in the state of California. It feels overtly political. So I'm worried that the party isn't getting the message. We need less performative politics and more focus on government performance.
So you think the effort on CARB, which is basically changing some of the environmental regulations on oil companies, is a bad idea?
Well, the legislature held a special session on energy prices and managed, as a result, to push another refiner out of the state, which is going to increase costs. I'm all for the clean tech revolution. We were one of the first cities in the state, in the country, to sign up for aggressive climate goals. But we have to be real with people about what it's going to take to get there. We need a lot more storage, not just to push refineries out prematurely.
What do you think is the message from Donald Trump's victory? Obviously, Democrats in the state were able to flip three congressional seats, but Trump able to gain in this state and gain in counties across the country.
I think the message is really about listening to people about the issues that affect their lives. Democratic leadership, particularly in the state, is having a conversation with itself, with interest group leaders. We need to talk to people out in the grocery store. I have a hard time getting through the grocery store every weekend because people want to talk to me about crime and homelessness and the high cost of living. And we need to focus on driving forward solutions that bring down housing costs, reduce crime, get people into treatment, end this era of encampments, clean up the state, and create more economic opportunity. That's what people care about, and we're getting distracted by other issues.
And you think the National Democratic Party is doing that, too?
I do.
Yeah. And the first reaction to Trump's victory from the governor of the state, Governor Newsom, was to call a special session. They've talked about it as a Trump-proofing of California. You think that's a wise use of time?
Well, I think that the best resistance, if you want to call it that, is to make California work. Prove that what we're doing here is a model for the country going forward. That's where we've been. For the last 50 years, we were the state that led the way. We innovated, we solved problems, we were the trendsetter, and now we're reacting. And I don't, sure, there will be things we can work with the Trump administration on. There may be places we have to push back, and there may be some legal battles. But the emphasis should be making our state the most economically vibrant and competitive, having the best public schools, getting everybody housed, controlling cost of living for working families. If we do that, I don't think we have to worry too much about what Trump does. And I think we will continue to lead the nation forward. But unfortunately, people aren't looking to us for leadership anymore. And that's a problem.
So basically, if you were governor, it doesn't sound like you'd be calling a special session to try to pass funding to sue the Trump administration, which hasn't even taken office. Yes.
I'd call a special session on how we're going to build more housing where it makes sense to bring down the cost of housing. Expand basic dignified shelter and treatment centers and compel people to come indoors and get the help that they need. I'd call a special session on improving public schools and controlling the cost, the rising cost of energy in a way that still puts us on a path to meeting our climate goals, but doesn't prematurely drive up costs unnecessarily.
Sounds like what you're saying is that you think the governor is focused on the wrong things.
I think the Democratic Party in our state needs to get back to basics, listen to ordinary people about the issues that affect their daily lives, be honest that the policies and programs we have in place are not always delivering the outcomes we need. It's why I was an early backer of Prop 36. Mm-hmm. It's very clear to me that we were failing to grapple with this phenomenon of repeat offenders. We're failing to hold people accountable who are repeatedly committing crime and failing to intervene and get people into drug treatment to help them turn their lives around. That's not a partisan or ideological issue. That's a practical issue where our policies weren't working. And now we need to go implement Prop 36 to fix it.
A huge issue in this state is homelessness. This is something that people talk about in the grocery stores. They certainly talk about that to me when I see people. And there's been different approaches. One's called Housing First, which is this idea of let's get people into permanent supportive housing. The others is sort of an idea of shelter first, which is let's get people off the streets to wherever we have to get them because it's taken too long to get permanent supportive housing. What do you believe in and what do you think is working in San Jose?
Well, when I ran for mayor 3 years ago, I ran against the idea that we're going to end homelessness by having our primary strategy be building brand new apartments at $1 million a door. We need to build basic, dignified shelter and require that people use it. And we need to invest in the supportive services like drug treatment and job training that help people turn their lives around. That's not to deny that we have an affordable housing crisis. But the way to solve that is not to tax residents to build the most expensive possible housing at $1 million a door. It's to actually remove the restrictions, the fees, the process we have around housing. It's wrong that it costs twice as much to build the exact same apartment in California as it does in Arizona or Texas. We are in our own way when it comes to housing costs, and we need to look at the overall regulatory environment. The answer can't just be another tax, another bond. It's got to be getting down to the guts of what's going wrong in this overly bureaucratic and restrictive government that we have in California.
What obstacles are you seeing in implementing that? Because we talk about all these homelessness solutions, and then the problem keeps getting worse.
Well, actually, in San Jose, over the last 2 years, we've reduced the number of people living outside by about 15%. And the way we've done it is by converting motels, and that's a place where I give the governor credit. The Home Key Project has helped fund that work. We've stood up modular units and interim housing solutions. We've added safe parking, and now we're looking at a safe sleeping site. We're creating basic, dignified, managed environments with security, sanitation, and supportive services. And when they're available, we are banning camping and requiring that people use them. That's the formula. If we want to end unsheltered homelessness, you got to have places for people to go and hold people accountable for using them.
Another big issue, especially in San Jose, the heart of Silicon Valley, is artificial intelligence and this question of how does it impact our lives? How do we regulate it? You held a big conference this week with people coming from around the country to you to talk about this. What did you learn?
Well, yeah, it was great. We had our first Gov AI Coalition Summit. We had 200 public agencies come together in San Jose to share best practices. Look, AI concerns some people, and we need to take seriously the risks around data security and privacy. And so we have to get that right. And we have frameworks for being able to do that. But I think there's tremendous potential for new AI-powered tools to improve productivity in government. We can speed up permitting. In San Jose, we're actually optimizing bus routes. We can reduce the time that buses spend at red lights by 50%. Mm. We're proactively identifying potholes and filling them before they create damage to somebody's vehicle and make them pay for it. We're identifying when streetlights go out, when there's graffiti. We are proactively delivering services faster and more efficiently by using better tools. And that's, again, that's how California should lead. We should lean into creativity and innovation to make government better.
Yeah, and you're starting to see that there. I'm curious just broadly, because what you're talking about in terms of the Democratic Party is different than some of what Governor Newsom is saying. They haven't always loved a lot of dissent. What's the nature of your relationship with him and with the Democratic leaders in the state now?
Well, the governor and I and Speaker Reeves, we have an ongoing dialogue, and it's respectful. We can agree to disagree. It may be that where we have differences largely comes from where we sit, the positions we're in. As mayor, I am responsible every single day for making our neighborhood safer, cleaner, getting people out of encampments, and building more housing. And I can't run and hide anymore. I mean, that is, I go to the grocery store and those are the questions people ask mm-hmm. me. And so I feel that sense of urgency, and I'm acutely aware of the fact that many of the policies we have in place today simply aren't delivering the outcomes that residents are demanding. So we just may not have the same perspective on what it's gonna take to deliver the better, safer, more affordable state that people want.
Are you thinking about running for governor?
I don't wanna run for governor. I wanna run San Jose. I love this job. I have the opportunity, if the voters decide, to do this for 8 more years because we realigned our election date. And I love what I'm doing. My wife and I are raising 2 little kids. I love what I'm doing. My wife and I are raising 2 little kids in San Jose. We're very happy. I want to make San Jose work and make it a model for the rest of the state. But I am talking about statewide issues and Sacramento a lot, because the truth is, we can't solve it alone in one city. So many of our policies, the funding we have, is all tied together. We can arrest somebody, but what happens on the county side with the rest of the criminal justice system matters a whole lot. We can create shelter for someone, but as a city, we don't provide the health care, the treatment services. So we need state, county, and cities to all get aligned around solutions that work.
So that's a firm no in terms of the governor's.
I'm not running for governor. No, I'm very happy to be mayor of San Jose. I want us to be a model for the state. But that does mean, in fact, I'm down in L.A. today to meet with Mayor Bass and other big city mayors from around the state to talk about what the next year will look like and how we can work together to move forward solutions to homelessness and crime and the high cost of living.
Is there anybody that is running that seems like you would back?
You know, I'm watching and waiting, and I want to see somebody who runs who is not focused on partisan battles, who's not super ideologically driven, who's a problem solver, who identifies that what the state needs is to be safer, cleaner, more affordable, with more economic opportunity, and offers a set of solutions that are different from what we're doing today, because frankly, we're not where we need to be as a state right now.
Let's wrap up with something fun. We do personal issues, which is your favorite part of the segment, of course. This is where we ask about you, pop culture favorites, first thing that comes to mind. All right, you ready?
I'm terrible at pop culture. I know literally nothing in this category.
What is your favorite TV show you've recently binged?
Oh, gosh. Oh, we are watching this show called The Jackal, Day of the Jackal. Remember this?
I have not, but I got to check it out.
Pretty good.
Favorite movie you've watched lately?
Oh, man. Lately. Is watching Braveheart for the 5th time?
There you go. That's good. Okay. What's your favorite holiday song?
Oh, my gosh. Jingle Bells? Silent Night? How's that? That's
okay.
Better one.
And what's your favorite holiday tradition?
You know, fire in the fireplace on Christmas Eve, just hanging out with the kids and you know, reading the night before Christmas.
I love it.
Our thanks to Mayor Mahan. Now, conversation with Michael Knowles of the Daily Wire. Let's begin with some audio of him on our show a few months back.
I think it's taken the air out of the sails of really the only line of the Biden campaign, which is this guy will destroy the whole system of government.
We know there are a lot
That was Michael Knowles on The Issue Is from the RNC in Milwaukee this summer when he was confident that Donald Trump would win the election. Well, Michael turned out to be right, and now he's here to gloat. Michael Knowles, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Alex, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for my favorite introduction I've ever heard, which is, Michael was right. I want all of my appearances to begin with that phrase.
And by the way, I like your subtle branding of your cigars that you've placed.
I try, as always, for subtlety, nuance, and class, Alex. The Mayflower cigar is sitting right here, now that you mention it.
There you go. All right. Well, let's get into it. A lot of Democrats in this state were stunned that Trump won. Why do you think he did? And what do you think that says about where we're at as a country?
I think Trump is a really talented candidate. I know that there are many, even in the Republican Party, who still doubt that. But I think it's impressive when one can win a non-consecutive second term for only the second time in American history, win the highest office in the land before you've ever been elected dog catcher. He's good. He just brings in a lot of people who are not commonly on the Republican team. However, all of that said, I think the Democrats just really blew it. I think Biden also would have lost to Trump, but I think he would have had a better shot than Kamala. I think the past 4 years have just been disastrous. I think on meat and potatoes, kind of kitchen table topics, the Democrats lost Americans. The inflation was just too bad. The immigration crisis had just gotten a little bit too bad. Foreign policy had spun out of control. And then on the more ideological or social issues, I think Democrats had lost the common sense. Much has been made of the transgender ideology, specifically as applied to children. Now there's a Supreme Court case, U.S. versus Scarametti. I think Democrats really overstepped. And I think people who are center-left, more liberally minded, guys like Joe Rogan, people like J.K. Rowling, even in another country, these are people who want to vote for the left-wing party, but transing the kids was just a little bit too much. So I think the Democrats seem to lose the common sense. They lost a connection to the common people. And so as a result, Trump won not only in an electoral college landslide, but he even won for the first time in two decades the popular vote as a Republican.
You really think that Joe Biden in his 80s, the Joe Biden we saw in that debate stage, would do better than Kamala Harris?
Yes, Kamala's a really bad candidate. She's great behind the scenes. She works the levers of power very well. Obviously, she's had a pretty impressive political career. But people underestimate Joe Biden. I know he's got dementia. I know he's obviously in decline. Even if he had been firing on all cylinders, I think his record was just too bad probably to get reelected. But he's good at politics. This is a guy who managed to get himself elected to the Senate before he was constitutionally eligible to do it. He spent half a century in politics, got himself up to VP, was able to get elected president even after he was a cadaver by all accounts. So he's got a real talent in retail politics. Kamala just doesn't have that. She's just not likable. And so it was a mistake. Probably Democrats would have done a lot better with someone like Gretchen Whitmer, would have done a lot better with someone like Gavin Newsom. But I think some of those other Democrats thought, you know what, let's send up Kamala to be the lamb to the slaughter, and we're going to keep our powder dry for 2028.
Of course, Kamala Harris was very successful in California politics, winning a lot of statewide elections here. Let's go to the cabinet, the president-elect's cabinet, filled with a lot of billionaires and Fox News hosts and contributors who are really good on TV. What should we read into how Trump plans to govern based off the team that he's assembled?
Well, I think he needs to start picking more Daily Wire hosts for his cabinet. That would be my first suggestion. But barring that, I think he's made mostly really good picks here. There were some stumbles. Obviously, Matt Gaetz was never going to make it through Senate confirmation. So President Trump let that one go. Now the Democrats are coming after Pete Hegseth. And I think Pete has a much, much stronger claim to his office than maybe even Matt Gaetz did. The knock on Pete Hegseth in general is that he's a TV host. But I think that's actually a plus. Being able to communicate, being able to speak in a manner that is concise and persuasive, I think that's good in a cabinet role, especially when you're going to be the figurehead for the American military. One of your chief jobs is just driving recruitment. I think probably Pete Hegseth has already driven an increase in recruitment and in morale. Now they're attacking him because he's been married multiple times, has a history of being a bit of a Casanova. So those are fair enough attacks, I guess. But if those attacks are going to apply to him, then good luck getting Bobby Kennedy through. And you know, I think it's rich coming from the party of Bill Clinton, the party that tells us that marriage is not a serious matter and divorce is fine and polyamory and polygamy and all the rest of it. You know, I think it's a little bit disingenuous. So I think Hegseth has a really good chance of making it through. If he does go down, I think that's going to pose a real threat to the Trump agenda, because they've already got a little blood in the water with the Gates debacle. If Hegseth goes down too, I don't think you're going to get Bobby Kennedy through. I don't think you're going to get Tulsi Gabbard through. Already you're seeing the intelligence community come out and say, you know, dozens of officials warn that Tulsi is a Russian spy or something. Same kind of nonsense you saw with the 51 discredited intelligence officials who came after Trump. And then down the line, you're going to see some problems. But now broadly, I've only focused on the controversial picks. Don't forget, you've got Tulsi, you've got Bobby Kennedy, but then you've also got guys like Marco Rubio, a real establishment pick. Mm-hmm. You've got guys like Mike Waltz. You've got people like Elise Stefanik. And so and you mentioned the billionaires. Obviously, Elon Musk has a big role here. Vivek Ramaswamy's not quite a billionaire, but he's quite well off. So what do we make of it big picture? I think what we're seeing here is an acceleration of what we saw in Trump's picks in the first term, which is that this man is going to be unpredictable. He's going to pick a total dove for some positions, and he's going to pick a John Bolton for another position. And that's been a strength of his in negotiating with his adversaries in America and with America's adversaries overseas, is you can never quite tell where the guy's coming from.
Although I think we both would say that he's not going to pick John Bolton this time.
Bolton's probably had probably, his moment in the
probably
sun
off
in the
Trump
list. Circles.
The anti-Trump books don't get you there. But if Hegseth goes down, you see the leaks to the Wall Street Journal that Governor Ron DeSantis could be next. Do you think he'd be better?
I think DeSantis would be great at just about any job in the country. However, I'm a little reluctant to believe these leaks, because we have to remember, the fights that we're seeing politically right now are not just left versus right, Democrat versus Republican. There are big fights within the Republican Party. Joni Ernst, U.S. Senator, is one of the people holding up the Hegseth nomination. There are reports out that she wants the job for herself, so there might be a little bit of self-interest there. And there are also fights within the Trump camp. So there are factions within the Trump camp that are fighting and vying for influence. And so when I see these leaks to places like the Wall Street Journal, I wonder if it's sort of like a push-pull, you know, supposed leaks that are really just trying to get another candidate into a decent position. That is in no way a knock on DeSantis. He's an extremely competent, an extremely intelligent guy. I'm sure he'd be great in any role Trump put him in. But as of now, I think it would be a real, real big mistake to let Hegseth go. One, because I think Hegseth would do a great job in the position. But two, I think it would seriously jeopardize the rest of Trump's picks moving forward.
Where do you think that the Democratic Party more broadly should go from here? And who do you think would be their strongest nominee in 2028?
Woke Caesar Gavin Newsom, your governor, I think there's no question about it. That's not a phrase of mine. I borrowed it from the great pseudonymous Twitter account Edmund Smirk, but I think it holds. Newsom is a really talented politician. I am a former resident, as you know, Alex, of Mussolini's failed state. However, I got to give credit where credit is due. The guy is really talented at retail politics. I look around the rest of the Democrat Party right now. I don't quite see that. Josh Shapiro is somewhat attractive in Pennsylvania. He doesn't cut quite the same image as Governor Newsom does. And also Josh Shapiro has the baggage of being Jewish at a time when the base of the Democratic Party is become vociferously anti-Israel. So I think that unjustly would be a knock against him. Gretchen Whitmer, maybe. I don't think she quite has it. Mayor Pete, I don't think he's going to make it across the finish line. I guess they could have tried to run Kennedy, but Kennedy's with the Republicans now. You know, when I look around the field for 2028, an election campaign that has already begun, you mm-hmm. see Gavin Newsom using $25 million of state funds essentially to give himself an early campaign to run as the presumptive Democrat nominee. I would put my money on Newsom, albeit quite early.
Do you think that Newsom would be the toughest person to beat? Or are you saying that because
yes.
you want to run against him? You think Newsom is actually the strongest candidate?
Yes, I'm being disinterested and charitable to the Democrat side, Alex. Pains me to do, but I think he would be the toughest one to beat right now. Who would I most like to run against? Kamala, no question. There is a leak out that Kamala's told her advisors to prepare potentially for a 2028 run. That would be great. Please let me know where I can send my donation and if there are any federal maximum contributions I can give. I think she would be easy. Buttigieg would be easy to beat. Whitmer's a little tougher. Shapiro, I think, basically would be easy to beat. Newsom is the one who really stands out to me. In part also, not just because he looks good and he talks good and he's the governor of a big and important state, and he's been in politics since he was in diapers, but also because he's a great example of Democrats at their version of their best, which is he is quite progressive. You know, he was one of the first Democrat politicians to support the redefinition of marriage and bringing in same-sex couples back when it was still unpopular up in San Francisco. So he's got a lot of progressive bona fides, but he kind of sounds like a moderate, and he makes you feel good when he speaks. Even when the guy gets caught red-handed violating his own COVID rules at the French Laundry, somehow he gets around that. He's survived a recall challenge. So he's a tough politician. He's been tested. I, as a Republican, would not look forward to running against him in 28.
Well, I was not expecting this to turn into the Michael Knowles endorses Gavin Newsom's campaign. So this, we just gave
hopefully that. I can damage him by doing that.
Okay. Wow. Another big story this week, President Biden pardoning his son after repeatedly saying that he wouldn't do it. Governor Newsom came out and said that he was disappointed and frustrated by that happening. Were you surprised?
No, I was not surprised. I don't know anyone who was genuinely surprised by that. If anyone was surprised, they haven't been paying attention. The reason they might have been surprised is because Biden said point blank on multiple occasions, I will not pardon my son. Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House press secretary, said point blank, no, there is no possibility that Joe will pardon Hunter Biden. But Joe Biden is one of the most prolific and notable liars in politics. This has been true for 50 years. Even Democrats in moments of candor will admit that Joe has a particular problem with the truth. And I'm not surprised at all. You know, even just from a purely human perspective, one, it's his kid. It's his last surviving kid. So he's just going to take care of his boy. All right. Two, Joe Biden is deeply personally implicated in the crimes that Hunter is accused of, even the crimes that he wasn't even charged with yet.
We don't
when
know
Joe
that.
Biden came out and he said, well, we have a lot of evidence because we have Hunter Biden's laptop. We know that he was paid a ton of money, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars from a Ukrainian oil and natural gas company. He has no expertise in that. He was obviously peddling his father's influence as vice president, to say nothing of raising money elsewhere in the world. But regardless, the DOJ didn't go after him for that. They tried to go after him after much outcry on relatively low-level tax charges and not filing out a gun form correctly. So when Joe Biden in that pardon said, look, I said I wouldn't do this, but I'm doing it anyway because Hunter was treated differently. That's true. He was treated with much greater leniency than other people who had committed Hunter Biden's crimes. And also, I think Joe is worried that he might be dragged before some committees and he might be investigated. The one problem with the pardon, though, for Joe Biden is that now that that Hunter has this unprecedented blanket pardon for anything he might have done for the past 10 years at the federal level, now he can't plead the fifth.
Right.
So if the Republicans are inclined to investigate this, and I don't think they are, but if they were to do that, there is a world in which Hunter Biden now might be more likely to have to testify against his father if the big guy was involved.
Yeah, and just a point of clarification, Hunter Biden is his last remaining son, but Joe Biden does have a daughter, Ashley
yes,
Biden,
that's true.
As well. We want to play personal issues with you to wrap things up, to get to know you a little bit better and have some fun. These are rapid-fire things, first thing that comes to mind to get to know you. So here we go, Michael. What is the favorite TV show you've recently binged?
I haven't binged a TV show in years. The last one that I got into was Dark Matter. I made it three episodes.
Favorite movie you've watched lately?
Me, Myself, and Irene. Probably for the dozenth time.
Okay. Favorite holiday song?
Favorite holiday song? Well, I'll have to say, Alex, despite what appears to be a Christmas tree, it is Advent. It's not Christmas. O come, Emmanuel. Ask me again on the 25th. I'll give you a different answer.
And what's your favorite holiday tradition?
I love Christmas Eve. And Christmas, there are wonderful things on Christmas Eve, midnight mass, and all this, but I have a personal one, which is that with my stepbrother, going back 15 years now, we play the Frasier drinking game in the evening. And we sit and we watch reruns of Frasier. One person is Team Frasier, one is Team Niles. And every time your character does or says anything pretentious, you have to drink, which means that you are speaking in cursive within about 5 minutes.
Wow, there's a tradition. All right, Michael, thank you so much. Great to see you.
We wrap things up this week with a look at what is going on with the LA Rams this weekend. If you watch their game on Sunday against the Bills, pay special attention to their footwear. Let's begin with Kyren Williams.
That's sweet, I ain't gonna lie.
When Rams running back Kyren Williams, Ronnie Rivers, and Blake Corum suit up on Sunday, they'll be wearing cleats featuring the Axe ALS Foundation logo.
So much, like, just, I feel like I'm get the power from this shoe just holding it because, like, this is not a regular cleat anymore.
This is greater than football.
Football is my passion, but giving back is my purpose.
They're all part of the NFL's My Cause, My Cleats initiative, allowing players to highlight nonprofits of their choice. Running backs coach Ron Gould inspired his backs, along with wideout Puka Nacua, to support Axe ALS this year.
It really warms my heart.
Axe ALS is a nonprofit started by ALS survivor Eric Stevens and his wife Amanda. Gould coached Eric at UC Berkeley, and they've remained close.
Eric is my son, and that how much I love him, and I love Amanda.
We speak via Zoom with Amanda.
Coach Gould described Eric as his son, and he started tearing up when talking about it. What does Coach Gould mean to your family?
Oh, man. Whew. It's been over 10 years since Coach Gould was Eric's coach, and the fact that he still is so involved in Eric's life just really goes to show the type of person that he is.
Coach G first recruited Eric to UC Berkeley, where he'd meet Amanda, a soccer player there. He'd go on to play briefly for the St. Louis Rams before starting a career as a firefighter in Southern California. Eric popped the question to Amanda in 2018. Right after they got married in 2019, Eric was diagnosed with ALS at just 29 years old.
When Eric told me that he had it, I broke down and I cried.
Gould's own brother-in-law had died from ALS, so he knew what was coming, a disease that slowly shuts down the body, but not the mind, with no cure.
We're trying to change it from terminal to treatable.
Axe ALS, with the axes in the logo, is inspired by Eric's background as a firefighter.
You guys ready to raise some money for this family?
They help fund ALS research and awareness.
Right when he got diagnosed, he said, what about the people who don't have the support system that I have, and what can we do for them?
Coach G is part of that support system, checking in with Eric and his kids every week to say, I love you.
I'm gonna spend the rest of my life trying to help him and ALS to bring that awareness.
Coach G's current running backs hear him talk about Eric all the time and wanted to chip in by wearing these cleats.
Yeah, we were all in. It was a no-brainer.
I'm really inspired by Eric's story.
And it must be emotional also to have your sons now all stepping up for your other son.
Absolutely. And we talk about family, and that's what it is. Eric's my family, but I got a group of men in our room is my family as well.
One of those family members is Kyren Williams, who is especially focused on using his platform for good.
For me, it's all about inspiration and, being able to inspire the youth.
Kyren first learned that lesson about service as a kid. That's a young Kyren with Steven Jackson, who was then the Rams running back and nominee for Walter Payton Man of the Year.
Everybody welcome Steven Jackson.
This week, Jackson surprised Williams with big news.
Our buddy here is the Walter Payton Rams nominee for this season.
Mama, good privacy.
I feel like God put me in this position to play football, and this is what I'm able to do is to give back and, be, like I said, to inspire.
That now includes inspiring support for ALS survivors like Eric.
What's the bottom line message you want people to take away from this story, from the Axe ALS story?
No matter what you're going through, whether it's Axe ALS, whatever, cancer, it doesn't really matter. People are here to support you.
What have you learned from Eric's story?
Just to never take anything for granted.
Smile like Eric does. Smile like Amanda does.
What do you hope Eric sees when he sees these cleats on Sunday?
I hope he understands how much we love him.
Our final word, sent in by Eric himself.
Thank you, Coach G, for all the love and support.
Thank you to the running backs and to Puka for supporting Axe ALS.
Go Rams!
You can find out more at axeals.org.
our thanks to the Rams. What an inspiration that story is. Thanks so much for listening to The Issue Is this week. We're grateful for Mayor Matt Mahan, Michael Knowles as well. Thanks so much for listening. We have some bonus content that I recorded this week. If you want to check out my YouTube page, conversation with Senator Alex Padilla, conversation with Patricia Heaton about some of her activism when it comes to supporting Jews, battling anti-Semitism as a Christian woman. And also Nathan Hochman, who was sworn in as LA County DA this week. You can watch all of that at youtube.com/AlexMichelson. Please let people know about this podcast. Share, review, like, all the good things. And we'll be back next week with more content.